Barton. The next session is going to be about Chief Constable Mike Barton, chaired by me with the assistance of my team, who are in possession of two items I would like to transfer in your presence to the 2018 winner of the Sir Robert Peel Medal for outstanding leadership in evidence-based policing, which we will present to Chief Constable Michael Barton, who has already received the Queen's Police Medal. But this one is reflecting something more than excellence in policing. It's reflecting his role as an early adopter of what is becoming a tipping point process in the transformation of the way decisions are made in policing. And I think what you've heard in this first session of the day is very much consistent with the idea that we are supplementing and not replacing the professional judgment of police officers, that we are taking their expertise and, in ways that we heard last night from Andrew Papachristos, applying a statistical forecast to real people and adding additional information. Information such as, this person is the head of an organized crime network, he never gets arrested for anything because he hires other people to do the bad stuff for him, but he's still much more serious based on our other intelligence than the model might predict. And those are exactly the kinds of examples that Jeffrey Barnes has used in the discussions with Chief Constable Barton, who has, in his role as a police executive, influenced other police executives in this country and other countries. And in fact, just last year, Chief Constable Barton was here to be honored by an American university, the George Mason University, which inducted him into their Evidence-Based Policing Hall of Fame. After the HART model and the installation of virtually instant risk classification advice to custody sergeants booking people being arrested in the four custody suites of Durham, which, as far as I can determine, is the first time in the history of the police anywhere in the world to have evidence-based algorithms as opposed to opinion-based algorithms or theory-based algorithms or what-the-hell algorithms. I hesitate to see the word algorithm used as being the same thing as evidence-based, because it certainly isn't. It's just a formula. And where the formula comes from and how accurate it is what determines whether it's an evidence-based formula. So if we use that standard, the first time in the world that police have used an evidence-based formula with scrupulous attention to errors, accuracy in the forecast, and made it possible for the decision makers to take that advice. As Jeff just said, it raises lots of questions of, well, what can you do? What are your options once you have that capacity? But I do think that the right sequence is to build the capacity, and that wouldn't have been possible without Mike Barton and his team. And that team has put this to good use with respect to the Checkpoint program and other initiatives that provide a very substantial basis for presenting Mike Barton with this medal. I'm going to ask Mike to come up so I can show him and you this nice picture of Sir Robert Peel carved into this silver medal and Mike's name carved on the back, saying, Michael Barton, Chief Constable, Durham Constabulary, July 2018, the Sir Robert Peel Medal for Evidence-Based Policing. Michael, congratulations. And because the medal's hard to read, we also have a plaque that can even sit on a desk. But the most important thing about this presentation is that we would be delighted to hear a few words from you.
Thank you very much. So thank you. I'm deeply honoured that you've conferred upon me such a prestigious award. I accept on behalf of... I accept on behalf of the staff of Durham Constabulary and the people of the North East who work with us daily to make our world a safer place. Cambridge University deserves its world renown, and the staff of the Institute of Criminology and those involved in evidence-based policing hold an envious reputation of academic rigour and excellence that is allowing practitioners like us to apply evidence-based knowledge. I'm proud to have developed such a strong relationship with Larry Sherman, Heather Strang and the team. The students sponsored by Durham Constabulary have developed their professional knowledge, academic expertise and leadership skills, all to the benefit of the people we serve and the colleagues who have the good fortune to work alongside them. Our investment in the Cambridge Masters programme has coincided with and been influenced by the drive to create a professional culture in policing. The College of Policing and its members are making progress in creating that professional orbit. We should all remember Sir Robert Peel deliberately conceived policing as a craft rather than a profession. Professions in the 1820s were essentially corrupt. The gentry ensured the eldest entered politics, the second into the army, the third the law, and the fourth a sinecure in the church. Women were ignored. Peel wanted people with their feet on the ground who would police with consent and be measured by the absence of crime and disorder and not by their physical presence or for the laws they enforced. And albeit Peel's and Rowan and Main's clear vision of a democratic neighbourhood model remained largely intact, it was eroded significantly in living memory with the introduction of radios and the proliferation of new laws and regulations Parliament expects us to enforce. Policing and law enforcement are now used interchangeably. The law enforcement community or law enforcement partners are phrases familiar to us all. We should beware of such usage. An often casual slackness which can lead to a redefining of why we are here. Radios have played a part in us redefining ourselves as first responders, remaining available at all costs and alert to the next and inevitable 999 or 101 call for help. Neighbourhood police and foot patrols are now neglected and under-resourced, seen as an easy target when austerity bit in 2010, and still too often the area for cuts as austerity continues to bite now. Police Community Support Officers, PCSOs, are now in many forces the only patrolling presence. That is no bad thing in itself because of all police personnel, PCSOs embody Peel's spirit the closest. Nevertheless, such a change in emphasis further strengthens the bastion of response and undermines the wisdom of problem orientation. I was delighted to witness Professor Herman Goldstein receive the Stockholm Prize for Criminology in Sweden last month. Professor Larry Sherman, speaking on behalf of the jury, spoke for us all in recognising Goldstein's singular achievements over seven decades in advancing policing based on research, analysis and evidence. In 1979, Herman warned us about this. I know this book was a bit later for the pedants in the room. In 1979, I wasn't meaning you were a pedant, Dennis, when I looked at him. In 1979, Herman warned us of the dangers of measuring our work in time and the things we can count. For example, response times, picking up the phone or attending the scene have unfortunately remained our priorities and guiding principles. complaints from passengers wishing to use the Bagnall to Greenfields bus service that the drivers were speeding past queues of up to 30 people with a smile and a wave of the hand, were met with a statement pointing out that it's impossible for drivers to keep to the timetable if they have to stop for passengers. This remains amusing, but also wearyingly true, of too much of policing in the UK today. Bus drivers should pick up passengers and not have unrealistic timetables. The police should solve community problems and not just answer calls quickly or describe officers on task as not available for deployment. Only a couple of years ago in Durham, we were faced with a graffiti artist who was tagging the walls, roofs and bridge parapets in the World Heritage Site in Durham City itself. Part of the plan to discourage and hopefully catch the offender required the response car drivers to park their patrol car near the riverbank and then take a route on foot under several bridges and also some footpaths and alleys unseen from road or vantage point. The circuit was, by the way, most scenic. It was a loop of about half a mile in length and took about 8 minutes to walk. This part of the overall plan was met with immediate scorn and eventual non-compliance. How dare we endanger their colleagues and the public? What would they do if an urgent call arrived when they were at the furthest point from their car? Such is the attachment of police posteriors with the ergonomic excellence of the driver's seat of the patrol car that this part of the plan suffered from implementation failure. More of that later. The officer's genuinely held belief was that it was more important, nay vital, that they did not chance an additional 4 minutes to their response time to a potential call for service. Victims of criminal damage in Durham in the 21st century had been consigned back to a virtual 1979 to the bus stops between Bagnall and Greenfields. Plus ça change. Our Cambridge students have helped to establish a creative culture in Durham where we learn from others, analyse what is needed, then all work together to implement the experiment or the new normal. Our checkpoint programme, based on the West Midlands Turning Point programme, is now well documented. Other forces, including the Isle of Man and Surrey, are, I hope, going to implement the programme so that we can continue to prove or disprove its efficacy. We have recently expanded checkpoint into the controversial area of domestic violence, where the offender admits the offence, and in the process, we expect to deliver an enhanced service to the victim. Only last week we were asked to include hate crime after a groundswell of support from our stakeholders. We have also focused our support on a small cohort of frequent flyers who are both offenders and victims. This includes domestic violence cases based on recency, frequency and harm. We challenge their thinking, behaviour and lives, asking straightforward questions like, what makes you get to the point of hitting someone? On this programme alone, we have seen a 95% compliance rate. What is particularly interesting is that we have the conversation when the partners are calm rather than in the heat of an argument, and they appear much more willing to have the conversation with us. Restorative justice is a key component of Checkpoint. We embrace the learning from Niels Christie and others. Conflict seen as property and allowing victim and offender to own the conflict and use its emotional energy to create a new order, one found on rehabilitation and change, not retribution. In our 12 Street Initiative in Durham City, we have targeted the streets which suffer the highest crime, particularly burglary. The streets contain a mix of students and local people. Our police cadets conducted a survey designed to nudge the person surveyed. Just as a result of conducting the survey, nothing else, we have seen a 40% reduction in crime compared to the untreated streets. Similarly, we have targeted the streets across the county which suffer most from theft from motor vehicles. We encourage residents in the treatment sites to take more care by displaying posters entitled Easy Street with a clearly recognisable picture of their own particular street. Control Strikes received standard Home Office crime reduction and prevention posters. The treatment site saw a significant reduction in crime. I'm pleased to see that this report that this is now being replicated in Gloucestershire. We need to think differently about how we manage our risks. We did this with our registered sex offenders, who are now managed by our neighbourhood teams. The success or not of which has been tested as a before and after study. Excuse me. We have seen an increase in intelligence, safeguarding of children, and identification of offending for these people. We have freed up our specialty resources to focus on the high and very high risk, where we have seen a reduction in the crime harm index. And most importantly, we have seen a reduced overall risk to the communities we serve. We have also looked at digital offending, particularly cyber attacks, studying digital traffic coming into people's routers and trying to identify where people were being attacked and by whom, differentiating where attacks were originating from, local, regional, national or international sources. A trial is underway on predictive burglary. We have mapped 8,500 burglaries in Durham and ensured all the data collected is quality data. We have then superimposed modern mapping data and street scene images so we can identify, for example, mirrored houses. The work is based on David Farrington's work in Florida. We believe the algorithm we have created to identify the perpetrator of an undetected burglary based on the modus operandi alone will give us a 75% accuracy of identifying the correct burglar. The trial is now underway. Let's see if our optimism is misplaced. In Operation Bantha, we find it helps to allow staff to name their own operation. We rank order our current disqualified drivers who commit other crimes such as burglary and violence. In Bantha, we target them. We stop and arrest the disqualified drivers and seize the car. Seize the car for no insurance or find other disqualified drivers driving the car and still seize it. Albeit this is proving successful in arresting these offenders and taking uninsured cars off the road, we are more interested in whether it inhibits their other more serious offending. I do seem to have acquired a frog in my throat. Apologies. In Operation Divert, we have used brief interventions training for our staff to influence offending caused by the abuse of alcohol. We have control and treatment sites. Treatment involves showing videos to the offenders of how they behave when being taken into custody or the body-worn video footage when they were being arrested. We await the results. Of course, the theory behind brief interventions in healthcare is well documented. Not so quite yet in policing. Changing rooms is a novel idea, if not a novel phrase, where we use the custody... By the way, this probably doesn't translate internationally. This is a chap called Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen who had a famous programme called Changing Rooms, so I'm sorry if this is lost on our international students. Where we use the custody cell as a means of delivering the message. It took an academic to point out that it does not make sense to advertise the telephone number of Crime Stoppers in a cell, in the cell roof there, when you have taken the telephone from the cell's inmate before putting them in there. By all means, use the cell wall as a billboard, but not to advertise a phone number. So we now have 4 treatment cells in Darlington and 4 control cells. There are 50 inspirational words on the walls of the treatment cells, including when do you want to change? This is what we used to put on. Change starts here are the 3 words you see on leaving. All the subjects will receive the same questions at the end of the police interview about their propensity, intentions, and likelihood of changing their patterns of offending. Our clever academic will then have to predict which prisoner has been in which cell. We wish him well. Thank you. Let's just return to implementation failure. One of the earliest research projects we developed with the Institute was something called Park Walk and Talk, built on previous work from Seattle. However, our implementation of what is a pretty straightforward tactic of foot patrolling hotspots was pretty woeful. The relevant master's thesis became focused not on the results accrued, but how difficult it is to bring new ideas to fruition. It's illuminating that I have had to personally revisit this issue time and time again. I remain unconvinced that we have managed to totally change our suboptimal cultural position in Durham on this basic building block of leadership and operational delivery. Application of Sun Tzu's wisdom in The Art of War, where you accentuate the supply chain to make it look like you have a regiment, not a platoon, is currently in the design phase. However, I wouldn't want the government to see this as another opportunity to reduce our headcount. It should be noted that Durham Constabulary had over 1,700 officers at its post-1972 peak, and we now have 1,180. Everything we are achieving is through people who have experienced a budget cut of 30% since 2010. We are actively engaged with Twitter to see how we can use the impressive processing power of millions of tweeters and see if certain messages work better than others. Watch this space. Alcohol interlocks have been designed in America to ensure drink drivers don't become repeat offenders. Durham Constabulary car mechanics fit alcolocks now to checkpoint clients' cars who have an identifiable problem with alcohol abuse, not related to driving. And this is designed to nudge them into less problematic behaviour patterns. Every offender, when they are released currently, receives a nudge letter with their picture printed on it and a telephone number relevant to changing their life patterns. Currently, one in 20 is telephoning us with an intention to change their lives. Recently, someone with 20 years of active offending has rung their relevant helpline saying, "I need to change." Let's hope he does, and let's hope we can improve the ratio of those responding to the letter. We were the first force to install and use random forest forecasting with HART that you've just heard of to assist custody sergeants in their decision making, which has generated substantial interest and debate. That's Sheena putting down one of the MPs who asked a very, very cheeky question. When I sat down to give Sheena advice, it's because Sheena looked at me, and it's always a good idea to stop when Sheena looks at you. We have been praised by our partners in the voluntary sector for the work we have done to evaluate suicide intervention and prevention programmes. If you care, share increases staff awareness on how to deal with and refer attempt suicides. Results have shown significant differences in our test and control groups, thus assisting us to protect the most vulnerable. Additionally, the charity now has the evidence to roll out the training elsewhere. We have built on the evidence that the families of people who have a family member who has taken their own life are at a higher risk of taking their own. This knowledge has ensured that we commission support for those families and they receive it within an hour of us receiving a call. We have been the national driver for the work to develop staff surveys, working with Dr. Les Graham at the Business School in Durham. We now understand our staff in much greater detail and how we can support and assist them in continuing to do a great job, developing the concepts of LMX, leader-member exchange, hindrance stressors, perceived organisational support and public service motivation. We have evaluated mutual gain where we are working with communities to empower them to tackle things in their own communities in their own way. Some of our previously more challenging communities have been transformed. We have worked in identifying and raising awareness of coercive control behaviour in domestic abuse and what would work for officers. I was speechless when invited to the premiere of Rattlesnake, a play written by one of our domestic abuse victims in which she explored what coercive control is and how it affects people's lives. All commissioned and produced by our frontline staff under the radar of the bosses because people feel empowered. Blue Light Drinkers describes the phenomenon of people who have an abusive relationship with alcohol and demonstrate the highest demand for all blue light services. Problem-oriented analysis of each individual allowed us to minimise the impact on themselves and others and signpost those who may eventually want to change. We also continue to work on drugs. The Organised Crime Group Mapping, OCGM, management team in research and analysis are supporting a piece of academic research to be conducted by Dr. Kelly Stockdale, focusing on the impact of drugs on crime data and the community. Part of the remit will focus on the impact of one OCG's criminality can have on their own local community. This surely is the elephant in the room. The Misuse of Drugs Act 1971. It shapes the way we not only enforce illegal drugs activity, but also how society sees this so-called scourge. Let's consider what the world was like in the 1970s to what it is now. In 1979, Pakistan had zero drug addicts. In 1980, 5,000. In 1985, 1.3 million. In Afghanistan, prior to the invasion by the United States and its allies in 2001, 180 tons of opium was being produced. Shortly after the invasion, 3,000 tons. In 2007, 8,200 tons. Last year, 9,000 tons. In the 1970s, less than 100. There are now an estimated 500 drug refineries in Afghanistan alone. In the UK in 2017, there were an estimated 100 tons of cocaine illegally imported into the UK. Gutierrez, Romero and Oviedo in 2018 highlighted 200,000 killings linked to the drugs trade in Mexico since 2006. 29,168 homicides last year alone. $6.6 billion gross revenue from US exports of illegal drugs. They differentiate in their research between stable communities with no drug cartels, drug cartel controlled territory with little violence, and drug cartel territory with much violence. Violence seems to go hand in hand with government and law enforcement targeting the drugs trade. Violence also has a significant impact on the legitimate economy, revealed in lost profits, lost work, and reduced salaries. In just some of the regions studied, they had identified a loss in overall revenue of $9.8 billion between 2003 and 2008. Kim and Jihong describe the drugs trade as leading to a society epitomised by violence, corruption, sexism, drug use, crime, chauvinism, environmental damage, and human rights abuses. In Durham, our research with drug users indicates we close illegal drug markets for between 2 and 4 hours after an undercover policing operation. The incomers bring with them violence to win the franchise and violence to enforce it thereafter. The narcotics trade poisons Afghanistan's economy. It diminishes the state, stokes corruption, nourishes criminal networks and funds terrorism. Every spring, the snow melts, the sun shines, and an ever-growing portion of Afghanistan is clothed in a deadly cloak of pink, Papa somniferum. In the shadows of the American century, the rise and decline of US global power, Alfred McCoy suggests there are alternatives. Instead of wasting over $1 trillion on misspent military offensive, let's invest just a minute proportion of it on the country's agriculture, thereby producing more economic options for those who currently depend on the opium crop for employment. Ruined orchards rebuilt, ravaged flocks repopulated, wasted seed stocks regrown, and wrecked snowmelt irrigation systems, which once sustained diverse agriculture before the war, repaired. If the international community continues to nudge the country's dependence on illicit opium downward through sustained rural development, then maybe Afghanistan will cease to be the planet's leading narco state, with all its annual cycle of violence broken. remember also the 200,000 killings in Mexico since 2006. We know we close open drug markets for between 2 to 4 hours after months of painstaking and often dangerous undercover police work, only to find we catch the street drug dealers, not the billionaires that we are helping to create. We also create a more violent community. Heroin-assisted treatment has been proven time and time again to be more effective in tackling addiction than methadone, and yet we close our minds to something we have learnt by rote to be just plain wrong, if not outright immoral. But prohibition does not, and never has worked. Evidence-based policing is here. Do we not all deserve evidence-based policy and not policy-based evidence? Thank you.